Good morning, folks. Welcome. It is June the 8th. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We'll visit with Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll talk about the shocking jobs report, SpaceX's big IPO. California's minimum wage is starting to have a horrible impact to that economy. Shippers are facing shortages as a result, trucking rates are higher. And we'll talk about what that means to the consumer. At 11:30, we'll visit with John Scott, special agent in charge of the DEA New Orleans field office. He's new to this area. We'll talk to Scott about the drug threats in our area and throughout the country as well. At the top of the 11 o'clock hour, Aaron David Miller joins us. Aaron is the former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator for both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's also a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You would be fooled that we have a ceasefire going on right now as a result of the activities that went on over this past weekend. I think what we're ceasing to do is pay attention. We'll talk to Aaron about where this is at the present point. How would we describe this and where are we headed? At 10:30, Amber Northern joins us, Senior Vice President for Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Amber authored a piece about teachers' unions. Have they weakened over the last decade? And almost all states have seen some declines in the number of teachers who belong to a union. What does this mean? How is this impacting the education system? Folks, we're going to start out this morning. A good friend of mine, we actually went to high school together, and he's recently been named the athletic director at the University of New Orleans as UNO has embarked upon this reengineering of the governance of the UNO organization into the LSU system. Where it was before, it departed, and now it's back. So welcome with me, Dr. Michael Giolando. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Newell. It's an honor to be on your show this morning.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. I am very excited for you. Congratulations for the appointment. You're familiar with the UNO operations. You've spent time here as a coach. Obviously, you're familiar with the New Orleans area as well as the former athletic director of Loyola University and a former coach of the basketball team there and the assistant basketball coach under Tim Floyd, if my memory serves me correct,
That's right.
UNO. And I think you were twice named the athletic director of the year at Loyola and once as the coach of the year. So quite a few accolades. So welcome. Mike, let's start. I guess it's great getting back into the game. You had kind of departed for a while. Talk to us about that. And what does this mean to you?
Yes, this is big. I'm just so privileged and honored to have this opportunity. My last tenure at Loyola was from 04 to 14. In the last 12 years, basically, I've been an athletic director in the dental Medicaid world. I've been the dental director for the state dental Medicaid managed care world. And pretty much, like I said, it's all about compliance. So that training or that experience I had at Loyola and obviously my dental background fit well for that. Now this opportunity has arose, and I think it's exciting that the transition from UNO to LSU New Orleans, not LSU NO, LSU New Orleans, is just a tremendous opportunity, I think, for the university. And that's what got me piqued my interest to learn more about it. And the more I learned about it, the more interested I got. And, you know, my roots started here with Tim Floyd, like you mentioned, gave me an opportunity as a young dentist, 32-year-old graduate assistant. And here we are basically 25 years later, or 35 years later, being appointed as the athletic director, and looking forward in this transition to make a big statement for the university.
And not a bad shooting guard in his own right in high school. I'll just throw that out there.
I don't know about that. Chippy Lee was much better.
And he goes by the nickname Gio. We had a table that we sat at the lunchroom at Jesuit High School, and that everyone ended up with some kind of nickname. Some were nice, some not so nice, but nonetheless.
Yep. Well, mine was pretty basic.
So was mine.
People couldn't remember my whole name. Gio was pretty normal.
So, Michael, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges? Obviously, there's been a lot of turnover at UNO, now soon to be LSU New Orleans. What do you view as some of the top of mind issues that you have to deal with and some of the biggest challenges?
I think stability. You hit it, you know, last few years. You read, it's no secret, you read what was in the paper and in the news of, the financial problems that were happening and the cutbacks and the cutbacks. So I think with this transition, you're going to find more stability in our executive team of Jeanette Whelan, who is going to be our interim chancellor and chief administrative officer. I think she's going to dig deep and work real closely with the faculty who's been, you can imagine, sort of decimated as well, and just get some stability and increase enrollment. That's the push for everybody on this campus. It's about recruiting, not just athletes. It's recruiting students and get back to that healthy enrollment that will make the academic component right, to make our foundation right. And for me, and for our coaches, the student athletes, their experience, the whole athletic department, make it right. So if I had to answer, Newell, it would be stability, and that's going to happen through enrollment.
There are a number of us who spent a number of years at UNO, yourself included. I think you got your master's at UNO in education. And, you know, we kind of remember those Tim Floyd days. He was a very gregarious, outspoken coach, you know, and we had decades of just competitive, not only basketball, but baseball and some other sports as well. And there are a lot of folks that have that strong yearn to go back to those days. And I'm sure you've heard that from folks as you've made your way back here to UNO.
Well, you're exactly right, Newell, and it actually started before Tim got there a little bit. Benny Dees was very successful. You know, Ron Green in the late 60s, early 70s, that's where I got to watch and witness a small point guard that sort of became my role model, Dwayne Rebull, and watching those early 70 teams. So the athletic department at UNO is incredible, the tradition. We were national champs in golf. Division II, 71, 72. Basketball was ranked number one, final ranking, I think, in 72, and got upset in the playoffs, in the tournament. Coach Maestri, and when it was D2, was a finalist. And then he went to the Final Four. It really put the baseball program on the map. So as far as tradition, athletics, we have it. And that was one of the things I want to make quite clear to our alums, our donors, and our rabid fans, that we're going to build, even though we're going to be LSU New Orleans, because I was very fortunate to be part of that success or during that time, that privateer tradition, or history and pride are still incredibly important. We're not going to forget it. We're going to build on that foundation, not erase it.
Mike, you spent some time at a big school program too. You were on John Brady's staff at LSU, and I remember you having a conversation with you about you know, kind of the differences there. I gotta imagine that experience though helps a lot, right? When you come from a program like that to a program that obviously, because of the size of the school, is a little smaller.
No doubt. And it gives me a perception of what we should be striving for. And, you know, LSU Baton Rouge, obviously the resources they have, the enrollment they have, their foundation, you just throw a dart on any one of those list, it's going to be at the top. And it's the state flagship school, and it should be. So that experience that I had with Coach Brady, you saw some of it with our golf tournament that we ran. It was second to none for a college golf tournament, you know. Those are the type of little things that the fans and the supporters really enjoy. And so having those type of experience and see how the whole athletic department operates together, the camaraderie, the collaboration, that's what I want to try to take and bring with me here and instill that same attitude and same system.
Now, if my memory serves me correct, almost every place that you've been, you worked long and hard to get alumni involvement. I know that you've always said that alumni involvement is incredibly important to growing a program, maintaining a program, and that stability that you talk about. I got to imagine that you want to do the same thing again now that you're back at UNO. I mean, at LSU and O. LSU New Orleans. Excuse me.
New Orleans. Here we go. That's okay. Absolutely. We need their involvement. Those alumni that were here, like yourself, myself, and everybody in between, they have memories of the university, and they were part of traditions on campus and the culture of this university. We need their involvement. If they've been on pause for a while, we're going to try to reconnect, do our darnest to reconnect with them. I know our foundation is being revamped, the Privateer Athletic Foundation. And so those alumni that were involved in supporting the general athletic department or specific sports, we're going to be reconnecting, reaching out. We want them to know that they're welcomed, they're valued, and they're connected to the future of LSU New Orleans athletics. And also, strong alumni relationships are real critical for our student athletes. That's how they create opportunities for our student athletes, particularly in this NIL world. That's a whole nother avenue we have now that we didn't have just 5 years ago. So having a strong alumni relationship, I think, is essential for our student athletes to get opportunities and meet them, internships, which could lead into, permanent employment. And
absolutely.
So alumni are critical. I can't express that enough, and I hope I have.
Mike, what do you tell the folks, a number of the alumni, I've been involved and engaged in conversations, a lot of uncertainty. And because of the trials and tribulations that the university found themselves in, there really aren't many options, right? And I kind of look at the glass half full in this regard. I think this, at this point in time, may be the best move for the University of New Orleans to transition to LSU New Orleans for a whole host of reasons. And especially when you see a lot of what's going on nationally, the trending in enrollment and the trending in financing and things, it's not a positive trend. So you got to kind of be the salmon swimming upstream. Your thoughts about that? What do you tell those folks?
Well, absolutely. We've got to find our niche. I think, again, our interim chancellor, Jeanette Whelan, I think is doing a very exhaustive job talking to our faculty, looking at our enrollment and what programs are our strongest. I just think that you've got to be real smart with your money, what's available, and how to best use it. And go at it. Put your efforts in those programs that are going to garner the most students. Again, it's all about recruiting enrollment. Got to get and get those numbers up, and that's the position that the university found itself in And, you know, this transition to LSU, I think, can only be an asset for us at this point with that LSU brand. And the reason why the New Orleans is important, that brand is iconic. So you have this LSU brand that's an international brand. And there's only a few cities, Newell. You mentioned Golden Gate Bridge. You know what you're talking about, right? San Francisco. You mentioned Times Square, you know, Manhattan, New York. You mentioned the French Quarter. People know who what you're talking about. There's only a handful of cities in this country. So we definitely want to promote the New Orleans aspect and, you know, keep that as a focal point. So although, you know, schools around the country are seeing an enrollment crunch. You know, this is, you know, both of us, anybody that was in New Orleans in 05, you saw the devastation and the chaos. But I'm just like you. I'm a half full guy, too. Whenever there's chaos or devastation, I look at opportunity. So with this rebranding of our university, we've got to find opportunities to increase our enrollment. And I have total confidence in our executive team and our deans to put that plan in place. So that plan phase 1, 2, and 3, hopefully by year 3, we're going to be healthy, really healthy.
Yep.
With enrollment.
Absolutely. And I think it's going to happen. Mike, if folks want to reach out to you, they want to get involved in helping with the athletic programs or otherwise, how do they reach you?
They could just send me an email. It's giorla1@uno.edu. giorla1@uno.edu. They can call me on my phone as well. 504-280-6102. And I'll take all calls and all emails, Newell. I would love to hear from any.
You always have, and you always have, and you always will. And when I was so very excited to hear that you were named, and I said to someone, I said, "This is a true gentleman, one with a sound moral compass, and one who really cares about student athletes." And he always has, and he always will. And I think you're going to be a great addition to the LSU New Orleans family, and congratulations to you, and welcome back to the city, Mike Giolando. Okay. Gio.
You're so kind. That's cool. I appreciate those words.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate you joining us this morning, and best of luck. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Oftentimes when I see articles about education or see educational unions taking positions on certain issues that have nothing to do with education, I really am mystified as to why they feel that it's important to play that role. Then I often wonder whether or not they're as impactful as they once were, because in many respects and in many areas, it seems as though they have fallen out of favor. Joining us is Amber Northern, who is the Senior Vice President of Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Amber, you guys released a study on how strong are U.S. teachers unions, a state-by-state comparison. You did so back in 2012, and I think you guys just updated that original study here in 2026. If you could give us a template of 2012, and then, you know, what did the 26 study reveal?
Yeah, I think the bottom line is on a bunch of measures, teacher unions have gotten weaker over time. And I think the biggest area where we saw a declining number was in union membership in each state. So I think it was 34 states we actually saw the number of public teachers and teachers unions had declined since we did the report in 2012. And if you've got fewer members, you've got fewer resources, which sort of has a domino effect on, you know, how you can exert power in a state.
Do you get to feel, I mean, I see them taking stands on issues that have like completely nothing to do with education. Mm-hmm. Obviously, these are ideological stances that they're taking, which might reflect their membership. I don't know. But are you as mystified by that as I have been over the years? And I'm kind of curious if that's having an eroding impact on them. Yeah.
I mean, I think in many cases, yeah, they poke their noses in areas that don't have anything to do with education, even though, you know, in many states they're allowed to, you know, collect fees from folks who aren't in the union. Although there was a big Supreme Court, you know, law that was passed that basically curbed their ability to do that. So I think in many ways that's at least hampered some of their ability to poke their noses in things that aren't related. Presumably you'd think, okay, they're going to have to be a little bit more choosy about what they try to influence. At least that's the hope. But absolutely, they've been stretching beyond the bounds of education and using this money and other purposes, primarily to Democrat, you know, for the advantage of sort of blue state priorities and Democrat priorities.
What do you think is driving this? I know the Janus decision that you referred to, the Supreme mm-hmm. Court decision, is one that impacted it in a huge way. But what are other yep. factors that might be driving you know, this interest in belonging to educational unions down?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, I mean, I can speak. I was a teacher at one time, and I remember the union rep coming into the, you know, faculty lunch lounge and telling us, you know, how we could get sued. And, you know, for something that happened in the classroom and, you know, how terrible it would be, you know, on a teacher's salary, how could we possibly fight a lawsuit? And that was at least back in the day, and I have feeling that that's largely still true, is that, you know, they could often scare new teachers into wanting to join for fear of a frivolous lawsuit that then they could not fight. So that's part of it. And I think also part of it is that teachers mistakenly believe that the unions are fighting, you know, for causes that are good for them and for kids. And I think more often those causes, you know, as you just mentioned, don't have anything to do with education. But I don't think a lot of teachers realize that.
Interestingly, one of the things that the 2026 update revealed is that now more than ever, blue states, those that have, you know, a blue state that have a blue governor, a both mm-hmm. houses of their state legislature being blue, they seem to have the strongest unions in the country.
That's right. That's right. And that's a pattern that has not changed. I think, you know, the vast majority, I think we said it was either in the top 20 or 30, the states were all, you know, blue, not necessarily with a blue trifecta of both houses and the governorship, but, you know, historically had gone blue for many, many years. And so I think actually there were seven states that ranked in the top 10, both in 2012 and 2026. That were blue. That's California, Hawaii, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, and Rhode Island. Again, maintaining that strength in blue states.
You guys do a lot of studies on where these states stand in education. How do these states fare out typically?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's all over the board. Your listeners may be aware of the Nation's Report Card or NAEP. And historically, we've seen Massachusetts do well, not so much anymore, but for a long time, Massachusetts was the top performing state. And ironically, you know, have a pretty strong teachers union. So I think there's really no, when we look at sort of how states do on national metrics and how weak or powerful their state union is, we often see very little correlation. Many times because there's a lot of other things that go into, you know, how kids do on a national test. But I think the very one important point to bring up is that unions aren't the only big player anymore in education, you know, policy and trying to influence what happens at the state level. We actually found that there are a lot more, we call them education advocacy reform organizations. We found a ton more of those that have sprung up in the last decade or so. I think we had 30 of them in 2012 when we first did the report, and now we have 180 or more of these education reform advocacy organizations. So they appear to be, you know, given the unions a little run for their money in terms of influencing state policy and education.
Do you think that these unions sometimes get a bad rap, both that they deserve and some that they don't?
Yeah, I think in some cases we, to my last point, we think that they are, you know, often the only boogeymen behind the curtain that are, you know, trying to sort of do things that aren't necessarily good for kids. But again, you know, there are other players at the table now. We actually call the report a crowded table. Because they aren't the only folks anymore that are influential. So yeah, I think that often the unions, you know, are the biggest ones standing in the way of positive changes for kids. But on the other hand, you know, we can't just lay it all at their feet, given that the politics of education are so much more complicated than they used to be when we looked at this in 2012.
One of the movements that I think has led to this as well, you correct me if I'm wrong, my gut tells me this notion of less parental involvement in decision making as it relates to the parents' kids. We've seen that run amok in California. We're seeing it run amok in other states as well. Many unions have embraced that. Many school systems have embraced that. It would seem to me that probably some of these activist organizations you're talking about are those that are fighting back against that. The movement away from the science of reading. I mean, you know, almost every report you guys have done and others have done, reading scores are abysmal in this country. I mean, they're getting worse.
They are.
Every year.
No, they are. They are. And that's one of those things, honestly, where, you know, I think a lot of folks are finally realizing that we've got to teach reading differently because we've gotten away many years from the phonics-based approaches, which was ridiculous. And finally, I think, but it had less to do with unions than Emily Hanford Sold a Story podcast that just took off, you know, with the public and just really exposed how kids were being taught to read. So in that case, again, it's other players that are impacting education policy, sometimes for the good and sometimes not.
But, you know, it's interesting. I've not seen, and maybe you have, some of these issues that kind of take on like this, the qualities of some type of movement, for lack of a better term. I never see the unions kind of stand in the way of that, right? It's almost they embrace it and they're running wild with it. Not a lot of research on it, not a lot of science behind it. It's just like change for change's sake.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the biggest issue, and we at Fordham care a lot about school choice. And that's the issue where you see, you know, vehement opposition typically by unions, because obviously if you're in a charter school or a school of choice, some of them have the ability to unionize, but most do not. And so, you know, if you're going to set up a school and they can't get to the members to be, you know, a part of their union, then obviously they don't want that school to exist. And so that's where, again, it's been a long fight, but thankfully, we've made some inroads in the school choice domain. And again, it's been a long time coming and a consistent advocacy by folks who are for school choice to fight against the union prerogatives.
I can, as I look at the whole educational picture in its totality, I understand a little bit about enrollments going down in universities. Maybe a little bit I can point to some things of high schools, but grammar school, I don't understand how they have these declining enrollments across this country, and there's almost no state that is safe and secure on that front. I mean, these enrollment declines are incredible as they're being reported. I'm scratching my head. I'm like, well, where do they think that they're going to learn how to interact in society? How are they going to go about doing these things?
Right,
you know, education is not just about information. It's about formation. You know, and it's like, I don't get it.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think finally we're having to wake up to these declining birth rates and fertility rates that we're seeing not only in this country, but around the world. There's just sort of global infertility and declining birth rates. And so, yeah, I mean, I was just at a conference this past week where folks were saying, you know, how are we going to close schools without, you know, parents having a hissy fit? How do we do this so that we do it thoughtfully? We bring parents and communities along and let them sort of see the numbers, what we're looking at, and realize that we can't continue to keep all of these schools open because we're just, you know, bleeding money. And it's going to be a huge reckoning, I think, for many communities, you know, in the next 5-10 years. Many right now, it's knocking on their doorstep.
Amber, but correct me if I'm wrong, it's not just about the birth rates, right? Mm-hmm. Even those of are birthed that are there, there's a lower percentage of those kids actually enrolling in grammar school. Is that not correct?
I'm not familiar with those data. I'm very familiar with the data about, you know, the lowered rates of kids going to you know, college. But we still have compulsory education, you know, in elementary school. So, you know, if parents can certainly in many states choose to homeschool their kids.
Right.
Yeah. And we do. We don't have great data on homeschool, but the homeschooling data that we do have, especially since COVID, we did see a jump in homeschooling rates. And in some sectors that has leveled back out. But the kids who, many of the kids who were homeschooled didn't return.
Well, you know, the irony is, I think it's probably easier to shrink numbers of schools than it is to then have to flip and go back and increase the numbers. And I don't know that local government is in a position to do that. I don't know that you have local leaders willing to consume political capital to make these tough decisions either way, quite frankly.
Right, right. No, I totally agree. It is a very unpopular position to try to combine schools, for instance, combine small school districts together. I mean, every parent really wants their neighborhood school to stay open. And so, yeah, I mean, and to our larger point around unions, they're certainly not for, you know, having fewer schools and fewer teachers and that sort of thing. So it's only going to be made more difficult, I think, in the upcoming years.
For sure. Well, thank you for allowing me to meander just a little bit, but I love the work that you guys do, and I love reading the reports that you do. I find they're very thorough, they're relevant, and it's all about timing, and I think, you know, y'all are at the cusp of issuing these reports at the right time as well. And thank you for taking time out to spend with us this morning. Amber Northen, Senior Vice President for Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Have a great week.
Thank you again. Bye-bye. Thank
you. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So the 2026 updated study basically showed that the education politics landscape is more crowded, more contested, and less predictable than it was a decade ago because of so many more players that are involved, activist groups on any number of different fronts, whether it's ideological issues. We've had a lot of things surrounding transgender, the use of pronouns, whether or not parents should be included in on that information. What are schools compelled to share with parents? And the like, and a lot of folks dropping out of these systems or pushing back on these systems to make sure and ensure that they stay involved, that they have the appropriate information necessary to raise their children. And remember, I said earlier that education is not just about information, it's about formation. And there's no bigger role that parents play than in the formation of the moral compass of their children. That should not be left to others untethered. Parents should always be involved, in my view. And many of the local unions across the country have decided to take a very aggressive stance on a number of these issues. It's not just about national unions. You have state unions, local government unions that are representing. There's a wide variety of them. Some are very well suited, some not so much. But what's interesting in the study is that overall, the participation of teachers in unions is diminishing. Less numbers, less teachers wanting to be active in their representative union and choosing not to. In a number of states, they have that right to do so. And as a result of the Janus decision of the Supreme Court, they were given more rights that they were able to exercise, where you're not compelled to join unions in some respect. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. But, it's ugly right now. It is when we look at reading. I talked the other day about freshman professors said, my students cannot concentrate for any lengthy period of time. They cannot read. They don't know how to read. They don't know how to read for comprehension. Something is fundamentally wrong. And that's not a good place for us to be. Because meanwhile, the other industrialized nations, not all, but a number of them, their grades are increasing. They're getting smarter. They're getting brighter. There's more critical thinking going on, more comprehension. It's not a good place for us to be if we want to compete. We'll be right back.